So, I am sick. I have been sick. I seem to have my second cold now back to back. So we will see how we do. Recording today instead of Tuesday because it was just so much coughing and so little talking, it was painful. Today we're going to do one of my favorite sessions, and that's looking at our very own Art Kaplan and our former faculty member Glenn McGee's two well-known pieces, What's in the Dish, and I love the title, Ethics and Politics, a Small Sacrifice. It just rolls off the tongue. It's very lyrical. And then we're going to look at the Mylander rebuttal to his argument. Before I say that, let me just catch you up on the where we are with the outline deal. So I will be returning them. I'm able to do about 10 to 15 a day, and there are 115 of them. So we're working it through. This is what will happen. If you got an A or an A- on the outline, I'm going to respectfully request that you not meet with me while all the others who get not A's and A-minuses get their turn, because I'm pretty much telling you if that's what you got, this is all you have to do. So, of course, you have rights to access to me, but if you could wait till the people who are suffering have their time, then that'd be good. What will happen is Robin will create huge blocks of time, and then you'll find a time that works for you to get on the schedule. Robin will handle all that. You won't be assigned a time. Of course not. You're way too busy for that. There'll just be a whole bunch of time available, and you'll see what will fit, and if nothing will fit, we'll go back to the drawing board and we'll find more time. So that's what will happen, but it won't happen before Thanksgiving. So once we hit Thanksgiving, get everything back, we'll be running this through, getting everybody. What will happen, I'll give you more instructions at the time, but what will happen is you will revise an outline before you come to see me. I won't meet with anybody who comes with their original outline because I'm already telling you what to do on the outline. I want you to come with a revised outline if you want to meet with me. I'll have the original outline, the revised outline, and I'll see where we are going from there. So that's how we will do those meetings, to make sure that we get everybody's needs met. And I'll make sure I do fit everybody in as many meetings as you need. And, of course, we're going to be in that time crunch. So that's what we'll do, but we're not going to do it now. Today is Thursday. Next Thursday is Thanksgiving, so we will not be meeting. The Tuesday after that we will not be meeting because there's a colloquium. I urge you all to come here. He's a very well-known journalist from Slate magazine. The dinner is full. It filled up in about 3 seconds, so obviously folks who actually are literate, which doesn't include me, know who he is, so that's really good. It's going to be, you know, jammed, so do come. I think that'll be a great lecture. All right, I think that catches up on the announcement. So back to this session. As I said, one of my favorites. I love doing this session right off of Judith Jarvis Thompson, because Judith Jarvis Thompson is making the same move as Kaplan and McGee. She is playing on the opponent's turf. She is pro-choice, playing on a pro-life turf, especially in the politics of small sacrifices. This is absolutely the move they're making, trying to play on the opponent's turf. And it is a very important move. In fact, it's an essential move. When you're diametrically opposed, when you're in some complete, utter opposition with the other person, especially on the metaphysical claims, you must start with their metaphysical claims, because otherwise you're going to be trying to do metaphysical fights. Well, good luck with that. So it is a brilliant move, as Judith Jarvis Thompson showed us, to play on the side of the opponent. But if you're going to play on the side of the opponent, you got to be authentic in the way that you're on the side of the opponent. In other words, you can't get all dressed up like you're going to play football, but then bring a baseball to the game. So if you're going to play the game, you got to play the game. And one of the questions we're going to ask in the, especially the small sacrifice piece, is can they go all the way through with being on the pro-life side? Are they really, is this really a pro-life position one can actually recognize oneself in? One of the things that you're hopefully having done for the outline and will do in the paper is to make sure that the opponent's position is recognizable. Because if the opponent looks at her position in your hands and can't see herself in it, you've already lost before you walk out, get through the starting gate. And one of the things that we know from Judith Jarvis Thompson's piece on abortion is that if you start with the metaphysical premise that just, you know, and they're both metaphysical premises, either the fetus is or is not a life, and that's both metaphysical claims. But if you start with that premise, Thompson argues you actually can't justify a whole lot of killing. Maybe when one life is up against another life, self-defense, defense of the mother's life, and maybe when the assault to the woman's body has been so spectacular that the pregnancy has come from rape. That's all that Judith Jarvis Thompson is able to justify, being pro-choice, playing on the opponent's turf. She can get abortion, an exception for the life of the mother and rape. So then when it comes to stem cell research, what does it mean to be pro-life? And what does it mean to have a pro-life position and then try to convince someone of being pro-stem cell? Now, it's going to turn out to be the case that many people who are pro-life on abortion are actually pro-stem cell. About, I'd say, you could look up the data, but I'd say probably a quarter of pro-life folks are pro-stem cell research. So not half. I mean, the numbers that I see, and you can find the data on this, and maybe you've got better data than I've got, but we're about 50-50 pro-choice, pro-life on abortion, but we're about 65% pro-stem cell research. So there's some wiggle in there on the pro-life side. But that's, in my view, justified because the embryos that are going to be destroyed to be in stem cell research have as their destination point either science or the garbage can. This is not a position, the pro-life position that's pro-stem cell research, is not a position that says, hey, I'm so good with stem cell research that you can take an egg, take a sperm, put them together for the sole purpose of ripping them apart for science. That's not the pro-life position on stem cell. It's that women who are desperate to conceive and are using in vitro have to fertilize more embryos, have to have more embryos than they need, and sometimes they can't come back for them. They have 6 years of life in the freezer before they die of their natural death. At that point, they will go to the garbage can, or we could do something perhaps to redeem that life by doing some kind of human good. That is my understanding of the pro-life argument that is pro-stem cell. That's not the argument we're going to see here, and it's not the argument we're engaging in today. So we want to think about what the argument that Kaplan and McGee make to actually not even be worried, to not limit stem cell usage from embryos that were left over. This is trying to make a much more radical argument that you could actually use, that you could actually put embryos together even. No, there's no stipulation there, because the argument is that sacrifices of this small nature can be justified even if you believe they're embryo people. That's what we'll be checking out.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that, 25% pro-life.
No, I mean, Autumn knows how to do math. I mean, that's 50% abortion, anti-abortion, and 65% pro-stem cells. So this is Autumn's.
Right. Do you see a similar inversion of some pro-choice people being anti-stem cell?
No.
No.
No way.
So.
That would be woo-hoo, help me with that one. No. 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 All right. So what we're going to do here is look to see. Now, and I do want to preface it with one other thing, because I get a little, I find this fun. And I should tell you why. Philosophers, how they love to just attack. So you have to understand that it's in the spirit of, of philosophers being kind of aggressive that this looks like so fun to me to tear this argument apart. But what I have to preface it with, though, is that I believe that they're very well aware that these two pieces are akin to my piece, Presumption of Restraint in Animal Biotechnology, where I'm giving, or my piece, Creating Fido's Twin, where I'm giving it the old college try to see how far I can get in an argument, not thinking that I've got the slam dunk that I've got in some of the other pieces. In other words, you can give it a try to see how far you can go in an argument without having it be your absolute authentic, if I bared my soul, view. In other words, sometimes, for example, people in this class will either take the pro-PAS or the anti-PAS argument completely opposite of what they actually think to see how far they can get with the argument, to stretch their legs a little bit. I think that's what we've got here. And that's why I have a little bit of fun as we work through this. Now, that said, maybe I'm wrong, and so I will be the opponent of the pieces, and you will be the defender. Okay, so I'm not going to take the defense position. I'm not going to defend the Kaplan and McGee. I'm going to shred it. You're going to defend it. Because one of the things we're trying to do is learn how do you defend, how do you protect, how do you strengthen arguments. So your job will be to defend against my rebuttals to it. So I'm going to be fairly aggressive on it, and then you come back at me as that part of the voice. Okay. And then we're going to see Mylander come in with one particular claim that they make, that this is a war on disease that is justified. In other words, it's a just war. There's actually a just war theory. And Mylander believes that they don't have it in hand and that it doesn't apply. So we're going to see Kaplan and McGee, especially in this paper. It's not so much in the What's in the Dish. These are very famous papers. What's in the Dish was in the Hastings Center Report, which at the time was the number one journal in bioethics, and I say that it was at the time because Glenn McGee is the founder of the American Journal of Bioethics, which had its first issue in 2001, and many people now believe that the American Journal of Bioethics is the number one journal of bioethics. That's not what the Hastings Center thinks, but we're not going to get into that debate. The point is, at the time, undisputably, Hastings Center Report and Kennedy, the Journal of the Kennedy Institute, were the absolute top two journals in bioethics. They came out in the same year, 1999, and they have been reprinted multiple times. These are very famous pieces. Okay, Glenn McGee was here at the time. He was a faculty member. He now runs a center in Kansas, and he is still the editor of the American Journal of Bioethics, which now has two offshoots, AJOB, neuroscience, and AJOB primary research. So he's a very, very big player in the field, and Art, well, he couldn't be bigger than that. So there you go. All right. They're playing, in this piece, the pro-life role from a consequentialist perspective. They are consequentialists, so they're not playing at consequentialism. They're only playing at being pro-life, and we'll see how well they do. They're authentically consequentialists. Mylander is a deontologist from the pro-life perspective, and he's going to argue that their arguments aren't supportable from a pro-life, at least deontological perspective. And I'm going to argue that there's no pro-life consequentialist who will actually find these arguments supportable. So, and then you're going to defend and say, no, you can't, okay? That's our job. Anybody confused? Alrighty, so here we go. The first piece is called What's in the Dish? And it's coming off of a company, Geron, that was engaging in stem cell research that set up an ethics board. And the considered view of that ethics board was that stem cell research was permissible, but stem cell research was a grave and serious matter in the same way that abortion, they argued, was a serious matter. That there were serious moral concerns that one could legitimately raise about the status of an embryo, a very young embryo, and what we are allowed, what the boundaries of treatment are of that embryo. But they came down with the conclusion that a developmental approach, what is nicknamed the DA in this piece, the developmental approach, justified stem cell research because they argued the Geron Ethics Board, which is in this article referred to as the EAB, because the EAB argued that viability is the real marker on this continuum from conception to birth that marks human personhood. And that stem cell research happens with embryos much, much younger. Now, this is not a pro-life position, because the pro-life position is that you have life at moment one. But they argued that most people, or at least the people that mattered on the ethics board, saw viability as the true marker. That's the position Kaplan and McGee are arguing against. And they're arguing against it because they believe it gives up too much to the pro-life side. It cedes too much ground. It gives up too much terrain. And they make two arguments, at least as best as I can tell. The piece is a little fuzzy in my view. But they're making two arguments to try to argue that the Geron EAB doesn't go far enough, is too conservative, is too restrictive when it comes to stem cell research. Not in what they ultimately conclude, because they conclude, let's have stem cell research. But they don't conclude it powerfully enough that you would actually think it was appropriate by the EAB's view that you could take a sperm, take an egg, for the sole intention of stem cell research, get them together in the petri dish and then rip them apart. This is about leftover embryos, or even about stem cells that you might be able to harvest from an aborted fetus, which we're going to put off the table for now, because they do. So this, if embryos, and we got to get our petri dish ready. Autumn can't draw to save herself. if an embryo has to be treated with serious moral consideration, that's the developmental approach. I'll give you a little bit more information on it. That's the view. It's serious, it's just not a person. Then, for example, creating embryos for stem cell research for that very purpose would not be supportable. Whereas if an embryo in a dish is not serious, just like, and sometimes I can't actually isolate just one piece, so I end up taking a whole clump out. There we go. Just like this right here. I'm sorry to the custodians. It's just not serious. It's just not serious. So if you want to do that to your hair, preferably not to mine, that's okay. And in fact, look, you can just step on it. That's what Kaplan and McGee are arguing about embryos, that if we cede ground to say that this is serious, then we can't manipulate them willy-nilly, put them together to take them apart. Now, if there's good reason not to, if there's good reason to be serious about embryos, they'd be fine with that, but they think there aren't. Or at least they think that there's reason to question it, the seriousness of embryos that are in the dish. That's my understanding. The developmental approach says that as the fetus develops, as the embryo develops into a fetus and then on and on towards birth, at a certain point in development, the status of that entity changes. I'm going to use the word entity. I hope that's not too biasing. The status of the entity changes, but we always have serious moral considerations when we're dealing with a human embryo, which we don't have, thankfully, say many of you, with sperm, for example. Sperm, except Monty Python's Every Sperm is Sacred, most people are like, whatever, you know, you lose some here, you lose some there, whatever, it's not serious. Embryos, serious, right? And they're going to try to argue, maybe it's not serious. And this is how they're going to do it. This is my understanding. The first argument they're going to make is that there is a big distinction between serious depending on its locale. Here, serious. Here, not so serious. In other words, inside the woman, where clearly what we're going to be doing here is heading towards reproduction or deciding not to head towards reproduction, but we can't have any other purpose once we're here. There's a different meaning to an embryo than when we are outside the body. And now that we can get embryos outside the body, we have an opportunity to think about them differently. In fact, they argue, at least I think they argue, because as I said, I find this a little bit muddy, that when the embryo is outside the body, it simply has a different status. That's my understanding of the first argument. And thus, because it's outside the body, we might be able to think about it in a way that doesn't ascribe to it such serious moral considerations. I think we do need some air. Okay, now, here's what I want to ask in answer in response to that question, if I've understood it. I want to ask if the reason that we might, if we do, feel differently about that embryo in the dish, and usually in vitro, you're hoping that you got more than the one, for an in vitro procedure. I'm wondering if the reason we feel differently about those embryos than we do once they've been implanted and we have a pregnancy that's actually positive to the test is not because we don't care about them when they're in the dish, but when they're in the dish, we don't know that they're actually going to work. So I want to know if technology got so good that we actually didn't make lots of them, we just got one, and we knew the one, no hair, was going to be Talia when it's in the dish. Same Talia that's there, and then 9 months later, same Talia that comes out. Would we think that Talia in the dish wasn't as important as Talia inside? That we would be trivial about Talia before she got in those 3 days before she got inside? Because I'm wondering if the reason why we may be more sanguine about what's in the dish is because so many times what's in the dish never gets to the point of a baby.
some in vitro, for example, statistics will have you at maybe a 15% chance of success per cycle. That means you have an 85% chance that nothing that's in the dish is going to become a baby. And so your thoughts about what's in the dish are more about hope than about attachment. But if technology got so far along that you got one embryo in the dish, baby, that's, you might as well be getting that crib, you know, the bedding. Are you going Winnie the Pooh, or are you going to go primary colors? If it were that close a connection, I'm not sure the outside-inside distinction would actually make any difference to any human woman or her partner in the pregnancy. I'm not sure. I'm questioning whether being outside actually gives you less status, or whether it's the fact that we don't know whether you're actually going to work that makes us feel this way. And I'm wondering if you actually had a guarantee, if instead of being like, yeah, I've got some embryos in the dish, I'm hoping, it might almost be like, I'm going to go visit my embryo in the dish for those 3 days and just look at the dish and pray with the dish, or whatever it is, meditate with the dish if you're not a theist. But I am at least proposing that maybe their outside-inside distinction is misrepresenting the situation. It's not that they're trivial here and important here. It's that here they may not work. If we knew they were going to work, I'm wondering if the status actually might be exactly the same as the day that you get the pregnancy test positive and the day that you know you've got a viable embryo. It might be the same day if you knew that that's where it was going to go. Thoughts? And now I have too much air.
How can you presume that science is so perfect that it's going to be that?
No, I don't. Remember, there's a big assumption here. What I said was, let's imagine science got that far. Oh, no, right now it's terrible. Right now your odds that this is going to create a baby are about 15%. That's it. But that
is probability. Yeah, 15%.
But that may not be true all the time. Ken?
I think that your argument on the one embryo in the dish in that scientific future injects another issue, which isn't what Kaplan and McGee are considering. It makes it no longer an inside-outside argument, but an intention argument. The intention in both cases is to have a child, to end up with a child.
Or two, or three, right? People will usually, at least two. You never see anybody rejecting two. But many people, if their bodies can handle it, will not go with selective reduction for three. So, and most OB-GYNs are arguing that three should be the maximum.
Under current science, practice, yeah. But in the case that you're positing, it's now possible just to have the one embryo created, one embryo implanted, one child born.
Okay.
So, I think they would say that, whereas in the multiple embryo situation, the intention is to have some number X that's less than the number that are in the dish implanted, right?
Right.
So,
okay.
So there are at least some embryos in the current case which will not be which will be destroyed in the end,
or right.
At least frozen, uh-huh. not attempted to implant. So since the embryos at that point are all equal, you can have disregard for any particular one of them because its fate is likely to be destruction under any circumstances. That's not the case in the single embryo.
Yeah, but I don't know that helps their argument, because their argument is that it's not circumstantial about the relationship of the embryos to the pregnancy for why they're of less importance. It's that they're outside the body. And so if outside the body embryos don't matter, then there's no reason why we can't create them without ever having any intention of them going to a human woman. We could create them just for science. If these embryos in the dish and these embryos in the dish are of equal moral status because they're outside the body, rather than maybe some of these embryos have a little bit less, you know, have a different connection to the human woman because she can't implant them all, but they still have serious moral weight for the human woman. That's the argument I'm making. Their argument is once they're outside the body, they're not serious anymore. They have equal moral status, so why not just create them for science in general? Because once they're outside the body, they have a different status. They're not little pre-baby Talias going into the womb, going into the nursery. They're just tissues in a dish. And if we think about them as tissues in a dish, then we might as well just take Autumn's hair and put it in the dish, or Autumn's fingernails and put them in the dish, or your sperm, thank you, and freeze it and put it in the dish. All those things you don't mind if they get in the dish. We shouldn't mind that we have embryos in the dish, because once they're outside, they no longer have the weight and significance because they're outside the body. Because otherwise, the argument would have to be constrained to, as long as the reason we put them here in the dish in the first place was ultimately to facilitate the process of a woman coming to have, or a couple coming to have a child, then if they're left over, they can go to science, is a very different argument than we don't have to wait for leftover embryos. As long as they're outside the dish, they're not serious, and if they're not serious, they can go directly to science.
Is there anything to be said for what the natural consequences of that embryo would be if we were to do nothing? So, an embryo in a woman's stomach, the expected natural
consequences... And then they actually don't go to the stomach, but that's okay, that's a technicality.
Uterus,
go ahead.
Whatever, sorry.
All right, that's okay.
The natural consequences of that is either a birth or a spontaneous abortion, whatever it may be, in a dish is going to be in a dish. There's.
But that's exactly why pro-lifers think that it's okay for these embryos designed to go this way could ultimately go this way. It is why people who are pro-life, and actually a lot of people who are pro-choice, even some of them, believe that it is fine to have stem cell research as long as they were left over, so that they were treated with a serious purpose, the intention was a serious purpose. Ultimately, this seriousness it doesn't accommodate their actually being utilized for the purpose they were intended. They are going to just be thrown out, so we might as well use them. It's a different argument than they're not serious in the first place. Let's get some eggs, let's get some sperm, let's get some science.
Well, yeah, but at that point, let's say we made them just for science. They're in a dish. If we were to do nothing, they have no value. They're going to be in a dish until whatever. So at that point, whether they're going to the body or for research, is like, is there anything to be said for the, like, if we do nothing, then
at that point,
so
I think that from the pro-life or some of the people on the pro-choice side. By the time you have done the egregious thing of throwing an egg and a sperm together for the sole purpose of just leaving them in the dish or fooling around with them or painting the walls with them or having science with them, you've already made the first error. Because you don't do that with serious things. You don't do that with things with moral consequence. That's playing with things you shouldn't be playing with. It's like taking a cadaver and be like, oh, I know, let's take some blood here and we could probably do a painting with the blood of the cadaver. People are like, that's whatever that legal term is of hurting the corpse. I forget what it's called, but whatever. There's a word for it.
Desecration.
Thank you very much. Right, there are things that are serious in human life, and they're arguing, and things in the dish aren't one of them. All right, but never mind that. There's a lot of really juicy arguments to come. So let's say you love that one. Let's say you think, no, Autumn, that's crap. They have a good argument there. Fine. Oh, I needed my thing here. I needed my approach. All right, let's go. So their second argument is this. They're arguing personhood is a metaphysical issue. As we talked about, fetus is a person, fetus is not a person, how do you decide personhood? That's a question that philosophers, theologians, in the heart of hearts of America, lay people need to decide for themselves what is personhood. And we are letting science step in on the developmental approach and tell us when personhood begins. But science shouldn't have that power. We need to think for ourselves, when does life begin? When is human life going to begin? And the reason we need to take charge and think about that ourselves and not allow science to determine it for us, as if science knew what was important in human life or the way to determine it. The reason we have to be very, very wary of science getting its foothold and getting its hands in the, and mucking around with our metaphysical commitments is because science keeps changing its mind. In the early 60s, Jackie Kennedy had a... Oh, it's even further than that. I don't have this thing wrong, right? Jackie Kennedy had a baby. Not JFK or Caroline, another baby. That baby was about a 35-week preemie. And, right? You're with me here on this story? Right.
because they were from Boston, and Boston Children's was the foremost place to save preemies, they got the baby to Boston Children's to try to save it. And they couldn't save it because the lungs weren't developed enough, and the baby died at 35 weeks, a healthy baby. Today, if you have a baby, 35-week baby, you'll probably be out of the hospital in 2 or 3 days with that 35-week baby. They're the Ann Geddens babies with the big flowers and stuff that you fit in the palm of your hand. Surfactants and developing the lungs and NICU units are able to get those babies in labor to get the stuff they need and to get out there and get into the world. You do not, unless there's something wrong fundamentally with the baby, just by being early, you do not lose a 35-weeker. In fact, 35 weeks, it's like I said, it's child's play. In fact, if you're on bed rest because they're afraid of early labor, guess what happens to you at 36 weeks? They let you free. They're like, it's fine, get up, go. 36 weeks, and they couldn't save a 35-weeker in the early 60s. What's the number of week you have to be to have a decent chance right now? Let's go to her. What do you have to be?
Well, it depends what you consider a decent
chance. I know. So give me the
2 weeks is usually
how many?
The most. 32 weeks for most gestation. For most pediatricians would be like, whew, I'm past 32 weeks.
Fine, but now I'm talking NICU.
But at the edge of life, it would be 24 weeks.
24 weeks, exactly, 24 weeks. And actually, a lot of NICU folks will tell you that at 26, 27 weeks, you actually have a chance of even being a healthy kid someday. Not blind, deaf, cerebral palsy, a lot of disabilities, cognitive impairments. 26, 27 weeks, and they're actually thinking you've got a decent chance of actually having a normal life. 26 weeks and they couldn't save a 35-weeker. What does that mean? In the 60s, what does that mean? Viability is moving back and back and back till right now it's at 24 weeks. When I started this job, it was at 28 weeks. That's how much science is moving, moving, moving. And you can see that what this is meaning, the implication is that viability and the time when what we've got is serious in here. The time in which we are worried about personhood is being moved up, 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 up closer. And that feels like it's encroaching for the person who's pro-choice. Now, because it could get to a point, they argue in this paper, where, my God, maybe you'll be at 9 weeks and you'll be able to save that baby. You'll have some kind of transfer, I don't know, maybe not. Maybe never. You know, sometimes it looks like things are inching, 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 but then there's a wall, so I'm not saying. My point, though, is that they're concerned that if viability keeps moving, it's going to actually threaten things like first trimester elective abortions. Because people will say, well, wait a minute, the first trimester ends at 12 weeks. If you've got viability a little bit before that or right around that, what does that mean for elective termination if you put personhood at viability? Now, my question to you is this. If you found out, because science got so far, that they could take an 11-week fetus or an 8 or a 9-week fetus and they could put it in some type of NICU, it would be the super NICU, the neo-neo, you know, NICU or whatever, and they could actually get a healthy baby to term, would people who are currently pro-choice feel differently about the abortion, the termination of a pregnancy with a fetus that had reached viability? And my answer is, yes, they would. Not everyone, maybe. There are people today, people who will say, it's still a woman's choice. If you got a 38-weeker, it's a woman's choice. Yeah, there are pro-choicers out there like that. It's just good luck trying to find an obstetrician who will actually terminate a fetus who's 38 weeks, who's perfectly fine with a perfectly fine mother, right? If you've got a severely compromised fetus or the threat to the woman's life, sure. But a healthy fetus, healthy mom, 38 weeks, no way. Nobody's doing it. So why? Because we understand that as being personhood. The question is, would many pro-choicers be like, oh, I'm not comfortable with this? My feeling is yes, they would. In fact, the reason I think that Kaplan-Meier could go astray is that it is precisely science moving viability back that is changing when we think termination is possible. And so they're identifying the exact culprit of what's questioning abortion. But I think they're actually nailing what for many people, not every person, but whatever for most people, is actually the line that people draw to decide whether you can terminate or not. So it's not that science, in my view, against Kaplan-Meier, it's not that science can't be asked to do this.
We are always going to rely on science to do this, and as science advances, so is it going to impact abortion and stem cell research, you know, maybe if it gets that far, and that is just the way it's going to be, because we actually do think that personhood and viability are integrally connected. And I mean we, many people on the pro-choice side, not all yes, but many yes. And I think it can't blame science for it, that's just how we draw those lines. So I don't feel that they've got a winning argument there either. So when it comes down to how do you justify the trivializing or the perception of insignificance about tissue in a dish, I don't think what's in the dish arguments help. Thoughts, and we'll move to politics of small sacrifices.
I was thinking back to your first argument with the embryo that you knew would become a baby for sure, and being a true comparison to the baby that was naturally conceived and implanted by natural. Because in natural implantation, then what do you do about you still have spontaneous abortion, there's no way to...
And women cry here. They cry and they get depressed and people send them flowers and you don't know what to say. In other words, your point only proves my point because it shows how serious a matter it actually is. It's not the same as the stillbirth, it isn't. But for women who desperately wanted that pregnancy to come to term, it is a time of emotional gravity. So actually it just more enhances the problem. From the very day people get the plus sign, that's the day when the sadness about something happening begins, right? You get a plus, if you want it. The plus happens, that's the day that if the next day you don't get the plus, you feel a loss. And if you've already seen the heartbeat and you get a loss, it's exacerbated. And if you've gotten to the ultrasound where you can actually see some parts, it's exacerbated and it goes on like that. So women actually facing a miscarriage do grieve, not the same way as they would if they had held the 23-weeker, or God forbid, you know, the 38-weeker, but I think it actually enhances the point. Alrighty, I want to move, because there's so much to do here, I want to move to the brilliantly titled, Ethics and Politics of Small Sacrifices. And now, this is where we're going to have Kaplan and McGee playing on the side of the opponent as pro-life. They're going to say, all right, I'm going to go with you here. Embryos are people. But in good consequentialist fashion, just by being a person doesn't guarantee you a right to existence where you can't have your interest traded off for the good of the community. And what do I mean by that? You wrote a consequentialist paper with some of you without the theory behind it, because you know that's the spring class. I hope you'll come back. But the theory behind consequentialism is you're trying to take everybody's interest seriously, and you're trying to maximize the greatest amount of those interests, the greatest sum total of those interests for the greatest number. You're trying to do the greatest good for the greatest number. That's the tagline of consequentialism. And as such, sometimes you have to trade off some of these for others of these, or for the interests of others of these. Like what? Well, for example, sometimes you have to go to war. We got people in Afghanistan and Iraq right now. And we know they're in harm's way, and some of them will be killed. And we let that happen. And we let that happen, hopefully, because it's going to produce the greatest good for the greatest number. Sometimes we disagree about what, when we ought to be trying to maximize in what way. But let's just imagine that it actually were going to do some good. That would be killing some to enhance the interests of the many. So what they're arguing in good consequentialist fashion is that just because you're a person doesn't mean you can't be killed for the good of some other persons. And we've got examples like that, where we do sometimes kill people for the greater good. For example, death penalty. Why do you do it? Just for to be mean? Because of deterrence? Because it'll stop other people? I don't know why you do it, because you know it's not my thing. But whatever the reason is, it must be because you think we're going to get some greater good out of it, because you don't do it on deontological grounds, because on deontological grounds you got that big whopping thou shalt not kill. So it's kind of hard to justify killing people when you got the thou shalt not kill thing going. So it's really a consequentialist argument that gets you things like, until we get to Mylander, war and death penalty and whatever. Deontologists are very squeamish about that kind of thing. That's why they had to create this thing called the Just War to make sure that we could get the Nazis. So, and that's basically where we're going with the Mylander. All right, so now Kaplan and McGee are going to be on the pro-life side. And they're going to say,
these embryo peoples, they're important. Absolutely. They're just like these things. I'm going to grant that. They're all like these things. But we can take out these things too. This one, this one, this one, this one. We do. We do it all the time. We let these people die. We have to. We even kill them for the greater good. So if you've got the embryo person and you got the these people, same thing. In fact, just because you're an embryo person, you are allowed to be killed as long as the killing isn't unwarranted. Their argument is, being an embryo person right here in the dish doesn't give you super moral status. It just gives you the status of everybody else. And so if we need to kill you for the greater good, just like we need to kill you for the greater good, we can. Whether you're in the dish or in pants or in a skirt, we can kill you. Because, you know, we might have to. Now, why would what would be the reason that we'd have to kill you? Well, the best analogy is because we're in a war here, folks. We're in a war. We're on a war on disease. And unfortunately, sometimes we got to kill people for that war on disease. Now, the thing that's so weird about the first argument, in my view, is that it is not the case, actually, that we treat all of the things that we call persons the same when it comes to something like violence or allowing killing of those entities. Because, for example, there's something very particular about the way that we handle the potential of dying in a war and who is allowed to take on that risk and who is allowed to take on that possibility of being killed in a war that we send people to. Who are those persons? First of all, they're over the age of 18. They're not children. Now, if you're going to say one thing about the embryo person, you're going to have to say they have not reached the age of maturity, right? They are not over 18. Okay, so first of all, we don't actually let the babies and the toddlers take the fall when we need to go to war. We have the adults doing that. That's one thing. There's other features. What else? Right. Unless we have the draft, in which case you go to thank you, Canada. Unless we have the draft, people actually volunteer. And they volunteer when it comes to being a police officer. They volunteer when it comes to being a firefighter. So the second thing about how some people are killed in the service of the greater good is that we like it when they actually say they want to do it. Now I ask you to ask the embryo person. You want to be killed? Who's asking the embryo person? So the first argument seems a little weak because while it's the case that we don't feel like people have an absolute right that can't be violated to live, in the cases where we sacrifice people for the greater good, they don't tend to be children and they don't tend to be entities that don't consent. So the first argument, even if they are babies, just like this, that rock in the embryo and all, they're not the people that get killed. Because we don't think that it's warranted to kill those people for the greater good. So their first argument is already crazy. Mm-hmm. Second argument. I don't have the same pagination, so I always have to just kind of read where it is, and maybe someday I'll have enough time to actually get the article you have and mark it up. Whatever. Three paragraphs before the what is destroyed. The question remains as to what constitutes unwarranted violence, that's what we just did, against an embryo. And for what reasons might an embryo ethically be destroyed, for example, in the interest, and here's where I'm going to riff, of saving the community? Second argument I'm going to pounce on is saving the community. I need air. Sorry. In the interest of saving the community, we sometimes have to have the sacrifice and the killing of community members, because the threat to the community is so grave. And that usually, in our typical circumstance, we can think of as a war analogy, but there are other times when some have to be sacrificed for others. Sometimes the community is so under threat that there are going to be collateral damage that has to be done in order to actually save the community. But what's important is that we don't have what in philosophy is called an equivocation, which I think we have here. In an equivocation, you use the same collection of letters, in other words, the thing we call a word, but you don't use it with the same meaning, but through a sleight of hand, you sneak in a different meaning and swap out
the other word. So while it may make sense with one meaning of the word, when you flip using that same word but a different meaning, you've actually done, like I said, a little pull the rabbit out of the hat thing, a little sleight of hand. That is a philosophical no, right? Equivocation. You don't want to get accused of it. Now here's my worry. There are two senses of the word community, two things you could be referring to. You could be referring to the set, the whole shebang, the whole society, the whole country can be the United States community. Or you could be talking about, here are the people. I'm not going to make 300 million of these dots, so you figure out. But anyway, it could be a set of members of that community. That can be a threat to the community, can be a loss of some members of the community, as opposed to the entire community, which is what we have in that other sense, where we're talking about the threat to the entire community. And now we want to think about this important war and the threat that we're facing right now that's going to require the sacrifice of the embryo babies. Less air. Sorry. I know, you pain in the ass. All right. What is the threat that stem cell research is hoping to combat? Can't yet combat it, but it's hoping to. In 1999, it was absolutely not, right? Because that was, I don't know, somebody did the math, like 12 years earlier from now. And we're still not doing anything. So it's the hope of combating what?
Suffering.
What is it?
Suffering.
Mm-hmm. What? Suffering from what?
Disease.
Yes, what disease?
Neuro.
What is it?
Parkinson's.
For example, Parkinson's. In fact, if Parkinson's disease... Oh, no, I gotta go up. I'm one paragraph from Political Accommodation. Not even the most insidious dictator could dream up a chemical war campaign as horrific as the devastation wrought by Parkinson's disease, which destroys our grandparents, parents, and finally, many of us. No insidious dictator could think of anything worse than Parkinson's. Now, Parkinson's is a terrible disease. 15 years after you have Parkinson's, which is a late onset, usually after 50, not minimizing it, 15 years after the onset, you're 65, maybe you're even 60 at the time, you could be seriously incapacitated. It does have implications for your lifespan, it does. And you know, it creates suffering, there's no doubt about it. Stem cell research actually can't cure Parkinson's at this point. It's researched to see. In fact, there was an experiment where they put, it was actually rat fetal cells into the brain of folks with Parkinson's to see if it would regenerate some of the neural connections, and actually it did not. But they're still working on it, and maybe someday it'll actually, I'm not saying that Parkinson's is not a grave disease. What I'm asking, though, is Parkinson's, type 2 diabetes, the other disease set that stem cell research, paralysis, serious, horrible ailments, that stem cell research is trying to combat, does it threaten the community in the first sense, or does it threaten the community in the second sense? I'm going to leave that whole bit about the chemical warfare, because I don't know. If you got napalm dropped on you, that would be not nearly as bad as Parkinson's, I guess. We're just going to leave that, you know, that claim, and just worry about this one. Which sense of community are we worrying about, seriously worried about, but importantly worried about, in the case of Parkinson's? The second one, right? In fact, if all of the people who currently have Parkinson's don't get any more advancement in their treatment than they have right now, which I don't think that's probably true, that there are people who are working hard on better medicines and trying to worry about the sequelae of some of the big drugs that are used, you know, when they wear off or when they have side effects. But let's say it never gets any better. Will the United States implode? Will that be the end of the United States? Well, apparently not, because we're 12 years later, and here we are. So the life of the community in this first sense can't actually be an issue, as sad and as serious as I want us to take Parkinson's and type 2 diabetes and paralysis. But in what sense of the community,
first, so we have actually in Parkinson's, we have the second sense. But in what sense of the community are we allowed to sacrifice, kill some for the benefit of others? Especially now we are talking about babies, where we're talking about babies. What kind of threat, let's stay with disease, could we be talking about where, if we had to kill some babies, I'm sorry, but we've got to kill some babies. Give me a scenario. What kind of a situation can you think up, disease-wise, where the threat is so serious that, yes, if it would actually stop the threat, we would kill babies? Let's not talk about embryos anymore, because if you're pro-life, an embryo baby and a thought, you know, and a 10-pounder is a baby and a baby and a baby. It's all babies. So let's just use the word baby. When would we allow babies to be killed? Under what kind of threat? First or second? First. And what would be the threat? What? Give me an example.
Is there a pandemic?
Yes. A pandemic where it started in the nurseries of the some of the major hospitals. And the people who are spreading the disease, I'm sorry to say, like in the movie Contagion or in the movie Outbreak, are the babies. So, right, let's just go back to Outbreak. Some of you haven't seen Contagion, including me. But let's go to the movie Outbreak. We have to rewind, you know, I don't know, 20 years. Some of you were, you know, like I said, weren't born. But that movie is about an Ebola type of virus called Mantoba. And this virus has 100% fatality. And it's in some godforsaken place like Idaho or Iowa. I can never keep them straight. But some small town, and there's about 2,500 people. Not all of them have it, but it's contained in this small town in wherever, Idaho or Iowa. So they're deciding whether they're going to drop a bomb to annihilate these 2,500 people. Now, what we know is that it has 100% fatality, this Ebola virus, 100%. And they give us a little map where they show us that right now it's here, but if any of these people get out, it's here and here and here, and the whole country's dead. Done. At that point, we will see that we become utilitarians in extremity. Of course, the problem here is that there's a monkey running around with the antidote in his body, and Dustin Hoffman knows it. Leave that. Let's say there wasn't. Because if there wasn't, would you rather kill the 2,500, knowing that there are infants and toddlers and children in that 2,500, or would you rather have 300 million all die? That is a threat to the community. And when we're facing that level of threat, we can talk about killing the babies and the innocent and the non-combatants and the non-soldiers and the non-first responders. Because what else are we gonna do? We're gonna all die? We all become utilitarians in extremity. We just hardly ever have any extremity. We'll talk about that in a minute. Now I ask you, is the existence of Parkinson's among us, as sad as it is, gonna give us 100% fatality and the United States will no longer exist? No. Okay, so we have an equivocation there on community, which wipes out the second argument. How about this one? My cure requires the sacrifice of your life. Third argument, let me find it for you. The question remains, though, what need is so great that it rises to the level where every member of the human family, even the smallest of humans, politics of small sacrifices, even the smallest of humans might sacrifice? Already it is clear that we believe that there is no more obvious or compelling need than the suffering of half the world at the hands of a miserable disease. Your disease requires my sacrifice. It's not small, it's my whole life, it's just that I'm small, because I'm only 5'2". And if I'm an embryo, I'm almost microscopic. So I'm small, but it's the whole shebang. It's my life. Your cure requires my life. That's the argument. Now, if you take a bunch of embryo babies and kill them, and I don't know how many you want to kill, the embryo babies, to get your stem cells. I don't know. Let's say that many. What is your probability that killing these six embryo babies, let's say, will give you a cure for somebody's disease? What's your probability right now? Kill six embryo babies right now today. How many do you cure?
Zero.
That's unfortunate.
Or next to zero.
Okay. What's your probability that they will, you know how these stem cells, they keep proliferating. So they'll proliferate long enough so that we actually will muster up a cure and they will be involved in it, or at least indirectly. How soon are we? How close are we to getting somebody a serious cure, a serious therapy for type 2 diabetes, you know, pancreatic cells or nerve cells or who, whatever cells. Give me an estimate. I don't know. This is a pull it out of the hat number.
5 years.
You think we're that close?
You said pull it out of the hat.
I know, right? Now I'm blaming you for it. Nice. Last time you talked. Right, exactly. 5 years. Right. Huh? 5 to 20 years. Let's get at that. All right, let's do a range. 5 to 20 years. Anybody want to go a higher number than 20? Huh?
What about, I mean, you may, excuse me, you may be using the cells a day for research that may not prove directly applicable to for Parkinson's, but that cell line is still directly
proliferating. No, I'm giving you that. That's why I'm asking, how long is it going to take? Let's say those stem cell lines keep going and proliferating and they're somehow contributing to the enterprise. So in 5 to 20 years, what are the odds? Think they're pretty good of curing? Well, I'm going to do this. I think that's fair, right? I don't know, but it very well may. The death of this embryo baby today may result in 20 years in at least the contribution to somebody's cure. But at this point, it's still an if, right? Because we don't know. The stem cell lines might die before then, or maybe the research doesn't pan out, or I don't know what it is.
But if the line dies, can't you?
The knowledge.
Yeah,
but then you're going to have a lot more embryo babies, right? If the line dies out and then they need to kill more embryo babies, they'll have had to kill early embryo babies and later embryo babies for the same cure, right? When we have to keep adding, you can't have it both ways, right? If these three do in 20 years directly lead to it, if they don't, we had to get other ones.
Well, and to get an effective cure, you probably need lots of different types of embryo babies.
Yeah, so you've got a whole set here, no chance now, and I'm going to make a point with this in a second, but maybe in 5 to 20 years, maybe you do have a chance. That's all I'm trying to say. Or not. Okay, here we go. Let's call this embryo baby Talia, except that she's not an embryo baby anymore. She's further along. In fact, she's 6 months. Unfortunately, she meets an unhappy end. But that's okay, because we can get her organs. How many organs can you get out? Maybe you're not going to even give. Maybe you're going to have to give me 16 months. I don't know if a 6-month-old is good for organ donation. Are they? Oh, they are. Then they'll be good. How many people can you literally save by killing this particular baby?
I think it's 13.
Okay, 13. 13 at 100%, or let's say some are too sick to save. 90% success rate, 13, by taking this child and killing it. Now we don't, though. That's the weird thing. If somebody naturally dies from some nasty twist of fate, we talk about organ donation. But we don't actually get the baby or the toddler and say, ooh, we got one now. One in the hand is worth 13 in the bush. So we'll take the one baby and we'll hack it up to get the organs for 13. But if those 13 people don't get the organs, what happens to those people?
They die.
If the people with Parkinson's or type 2 diabetes don't get the stem cells today, their disease will be chronically managed, and sometimes these illnesses actually are fatal. But it's not that they will certainly die without the stem cell therapy. And yet, when it comes to a clear connection between kill one, save 13, we won't do it. But when we might have to kill a whole bunch for no prospect of cure today and the hope of prospect tomorrow, your cure demands my sacrifice of my life or that child's life? No. Because nobody denies that that's a person. Nobody's going to take a person, even a homeless person, or a death row person, or somebody who's really just nasty person, and hack them up to save the 13. So it cannot be the case that your cure requires the sacrifice of my life. Well, then what explains how these poor babies, their sacrifice is required for my potential cure? What would explain that? Because even a good consequentialist will not take some person off the street, a la coma, and start hacking them up for their parts. So what explains this disconnect in the argument? You tell me. That's not a rhetorical question. I want you to tell me. What explains this? How could you make an argument that is so scathingly, obviously, not going to work out for you?
Well, if you're hinging a lot of this on the sort of like development of science as it stands today, I think you're going back to the embryo in a dish, which is
that's
saying
right.
Not all these embryo babies
bingo.
Are becoming babies.
You don't think these are people. You don't think they're people. But wait a minute, what's the premise of the argument?
trying to be pro-life here. If I'm pro-life, those are babies. If they're babies, nobody's going to hack them to pieces. Something's gone awry here. In other words, bringing us back to Judith Jarvis Thompson, she stayed pro-life the entire argument. I am concerned that we have left our pro-life pastures for the fertile pastures of pro-choice developmental approach territory, because otherwise you'd never suggest that you kill a bunch of people for the hope of saving others for disease. You just don't do it, because otherwise you got all this supply of all these people who can be cured and you don't hack them up. No, it's because you didn't think they were actually people. If you're gonna play on the side of the opponent, you gotta stay pro-life. Now what about this idea that compassion, or fourth argument in this first part that I'm gonna pick on. Oh, I am sick, 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 but this is fun. Where's my number four? Compassion demands it. Where is this stupid argument? We have a little four somewhere, but we cannot find it. Oh, there it is. One paragraph before what is destroyed. It is the moral imperative of compassion that compels stem cell research. It's the moral imperative of compassion that requires this level of sacrifice. Okay, so I have to sacrifice my life, because after all, whether I'm an embryo body, an embryo person, whether I'm a baby person, whether I'm a toddler person, or whether I'm a, I don't know how old person, this person, however old that person is, that's all persons, right? The pro-life idea is that it's all person and person, person, person. Okay, so compassion for others demands that I let you pull me apart from my parts. Compassion demands it. What's wrong with that argument? Compassion demands it. What do we know about demands, moral demands? Does compassion demand I sacrifice myself? Think about people who sacrifice themselves. Give me an example of somebody who would possibly have to sacrifice themselves. Give me somebody.
Fireman.
Firefighter. Because we don't say men anymore. Firefighter.
Sorry.
That's okay. Firefighter. What do we think? Well, what's the situation with the firefighters? How come we're not all firefighters? Don't we all have to be firefighters? Doesn't love of neighbor, love thy neighbor, demand that we all be firefighters? Isn't it required? No, why not? Because moral life has three categories. The obligatory, the permissible, and the supererogatory. What one must do in human life, what is required, is the obligatory. And it is not obligatory to be a firefighter unless you are all scoundrels. Because I bet there's not more than one or two firefighters in this room. And I'm hoping there are more than one or two decent people in this room. Sacrificing yourself is not required. It is above and beyond the call, the demand, the duty. Now, once you sign on to be a firefighter and now there's a burning building, you can't be like, whoop, I'm out of here. All right, well, then that was a firefighter who didn't live up to his or her commitment. But we're not required to be living above and beyond the call of duty. Some people sacrifice their lives for other people, and we call them heroes. But we do not demand that people be heroes. We demand that they meet their obligations, that they honor their promises, that they do what they can to help others in need, that they don't forego the possibility or potential of saving someone's life if it costs them very little. That's my 911 example. If it costs you nothing but a not, 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 hello, come rescue somebody. We tend to think those are in the realm of, you know what, decency demands it. But we don't think that you have to go and sacrifice your bodily health for someone else. So how could it be the case that the babies have to do that? The babies have to, because otherwise they're not compassionate? Well, here's the problem beyond these. In moral life, we don't actually condemn the actions, the failed moral, rising to the moral bar, of entities that are actually not fully mature and grown. Morality adheres to adults, or at least to those who are pretty close to adults. In other words, when you look at a 9-year-old,
and that 9-year-old lies, it feels different than when the 25-year-old or 50-year-old lies. The 9-year-old we think is still forming. So we don't say, you know what, there is no hope for you. I mean, you will be a vicious scoundrel your entire life. No, that's why we don't actually treat 9-year-olds the same way we treat the adults who do bad things. Either in our mind or in our judgment, we still think their moral life is forming. That means that we don't actually hold them accountable. We ask them, we try to get them to that bar. That's what raising a child is. We're trying to help them become the moral adults we want them to be. But we don't actually condemn them for their failure to be those adults before they're actually adults. That's why we know that teenage years are really precarious, because that's when you've got the adult body and still not quite the adult mind, but you got all the ability to hurt yourself and others, like driving cars and having unprotected sex and doing whatever you're going to do, and your drugs, and I don't know what all people do. But at any rate, we understand that's a precarious time because they're not quite there. That means that whatever morality would require, even at the obligatory, we couldn't actually lay that at the feet of children. We encourage them, like we encourage them to give a little bit of money from their piggy bank for charity. But we don't actually think that we don't hold them accountable to thinking out their whole charitable giving plan for the year. We encourage them, we help them. We don't set that as bar. So compassion, even if it were obligatory, which it's not, the sacrifice of one's life, you know, mini compassion, empathy might be obligatory, certainly not the sacrifice of one's life. The last people you'd ever ask that of would be children. And then things really take a nosedive, because now they are like, all right, forget the pro-life thing. Let's see, I don't know if that worked, we're going to try something else. Now we're going to say, in the end, even if you have an embryo baby that you pull all apart, don't worry, nothing is destroyed. You actually don't lose anything. And here's why. I don't know if I can find it. I did. All right. Unfortunately, Autumn died on November 17th in a car accident. But everybody said, don't worry, Tali and Ben, we have her hair. And thus, we have her DNA, and her DNA is preserved. So we don't have to be sad. Now, you're going to say to me that in this first argument, DNA is what really matters. DNA is the whole deal. Nothing's lost as long as we've got the DNA. You're going to say, well, you know what? That's because Autumn's an adult, so there's a whole bunch of stuff that's lost, including my ever getting a grade in this freaking class, because she's died, that's beyond her DNA. But when you're an embryo person, their argument is all you've got is the DNA. That's their argument. Well, the thing is, if a building gets destroyed that was very, very wonderful, and in the end you say you feel the loss of the architectural merit and significance, if I said to you, don't worry, we still have the blueprint, that would not be comforting. There is something that they're missing here, even when they're talking about the embryo person. Something about how we infuse potentiality, even if you think conception begins at life, so you don't think we've just got a potential person, you think we have a real person, you don't actually think that the importance simply lies in the chromosomal material, such that if you have the chromosomal material, you haven't lost anything. You've still lost.
But isn't the reason it would be comforting if you said we still have the blueprint is because we can say, okay, we'll rebuild it. We'll make another one.
Yes, and unfortunately, until we can clone, you're right, it's not a great analogy, because at least you got the possibility of rebuilding the building from the DNA, and right now, with technology as it is, you can't actually get anywhere with the DNA. You can't get the building back. You're acting like that's an iffy statement. You think that, do you know someone who can clone at this point?
No.
Good,
no,
because I'm like, I don't keep up with science, well, I admit.
I am a twin, but no.
Presumably, though, it a same time cloning. Twin, okay, not a I'm later not, born yes, twin. Okay.
But as far as you could
tell... That's good,
tell,
because laughing is good for Golds. Go ahead.
But as far as you could tell, you wouldn't really be able to tell the difference that this person from this embryo is different than the other person that was going to be from this embryo. I mean, if we're saying that the two lives are different and they're unique,
right, no.
That they are different, then from a pro-life stance, then I could see that you would say that they're different people. But
wait a minute. Whoa. I'm saying that when all we've got is the DNA in a stem cell, we can't get the baby back at this point.
Right.
So it doesn't matter. It sounds like your question is the philosophically powerful one of, if you had a baby that got, an embryo baby, that got destroyed in the dish, but you still have the DNA and you were able to clone that baby, and now you've got the clone of the baby, would the clone of the baby be like the original baby?
That's sort of an addendum to it, but I'm just saying more basically, even without that technology, if you were that mother, you wouldn't be able to tell that the child that you get from one embryo is different than the child you got from another embryo, because we can't see.
No, of course. But their argument is that if you only have one embryo in the dish, and instead of having that embryo become a baby, it becomes a stem cell line, then, because you've got the double helixy thing here that is in the one cell that now goes into the brain of the person with Parkinson's, now that we've got the DNA sitting in the brain of the person with Parkinson's, it was the same as having it in the dish that would ultimately go to the mom, that would ultimately go to the baby, because we still have the DNA. And the essential of the embryo is the same in terms of whatever is of significance that is now in the brain of the person. So we don't have to worry about tearing things apart, tearing embryo babies apart who would have gone to the uterus to become a baby, because now instead they're going to the brain of somebody who's got Parkinson's.
I see. And the evaluation ought to be in the chromosome.
Yeah, that's because they're arguing there isn't anything in here except you got your cellular wall, you got your mitochondrial this and that, I don't know what other part you got, but they say if you take all those parts out, the only thing that's uniquely identifying of that person being Talia, Autumn, Susie, Jamie, the only thing that's uniquely identifying is the DNA. Don't worry, because it's now in the brain of somebody else. In fact, their second argument is your chance of survival is actually better if you're in somebody's brain in a Parkinson's example, in a Parkinson's thing, than if you went this direction, because you only have a 15% chance of making it to a baby if you go the in vitro route, but you got a 100% chance of actually sitting in somebody's brain. So the DNA, not only is it the essential, because that's all we could value of the embryo in the dish, you got a 100% chance of life over there and only a 15% chance of life over here. Well, shit, then we're good to go. I mean, this is an equivocation on the word existence. It is true that my embryo baby, in her essence, exists in the brain of this person. But that existence and this existence are an equivocation. Existing as an element of DNA, Autumn's unique DNA, you'll never have it again. It's just me. In the brain of somebody with Parkinson's is uniquely my DNA, but that's a whole lot different than my existence. I exist there in a way, and I exist here in a way, but who's going to say this isn't spectacularly different meaning of the word existence? And my guess is you prefer this existence to that existence, and so would your mother. All right, so that one's good. And then the final argument here before we get to Mylander is this one. They say, clearly the pro-lifers can't actually mean what they say, that these are babies. Because if you had a choice between saving that and saving that, and you're pro-life, you don't have to think a second about it, you're going to save that. If you've got a baby, you got your baby in the dish, and you got your baby in the crib, which do you save? The baby in the crib or the baby in the dish? And how many pro-lifers will sit there? How many of you are sitting there going like this? And so Kath and McGee say, you don't mean it. You don't actually think that that's the same. You think that this life is greater than this life. And so you shouldn't mind sacrificing these, because after all, you're not really sacrificing one of those. You think you are. You say you are. You're not, and my thought experiment just proves it. But watch this. Here's somebody who's 92. And here's somebody who's one. And it's a sad, sad situation, but I'm now the firefighter, and I can only get one of them out of the house. Who do I save? The one-year-old? Raise your hand. Don't think about it. One-year-old. Put your hands down. 92-year-old.
Liar.
I'm just thinking, if I'm Peter Singer.
No, no, you're not Peter Singer. You're you. He doesn't look anything like you. He's freaking bald. What are you talking about? You are not 1 year old or 92-year-old.
Honestly, one.
Of course.
But.
Now wait, you know what you just showed me? That's not a person. That's not a person at all.
Well, you forced him to say it's not a person. He originally raised his hand.
No, no. Here's my point. We might have to make choices. It doesn't prove that you don't think this is a person. It means that in terrible, tragic choice, you will sometimes make calculations about which life to save, but it doesn't mean you're saying, well, that one's not even a life. Right? It's not like you're saying, well, we got... Here, I got one for you. Autumn's artistic abilities are severely challenged here. Okay, ready? This one or that one? We got the goldfish or we got the child? Which one do you save?
The child.
Thank you. That was rhetorical. I actually think we needed a poll on that one. And yet you decided just as quickly with this one and this one. It does not mean that you think that the elderly and the goldfish are the same. It's that you make distinctions based on things like this. The one-year-old has her whole life ahead of her, and the 92-year-old is already 12 years beyond the average American life expectancy. They've lived a very good life, and they probably don't have that much left, because the record in the world is about 104 or 105 years old. So at the most, this person's got 12 years, and that's lucky, lucky, lucky. But this one-year-old has a very good chance of another 70, 80, 90. That is a lot of what is driving your instinct. That does not mean that you don't think this is a person, and by the fact that everyone would choose the one-year-old and not the embryo does not mean you don't think the embryo is alive. Just like this experiment. If you had a baby that was 25 weeks in the NICU and you had the brother of that baby who was 3, you'd probably choose a 3-year-old too, or at least a lot of you wouldn't. That doesn't mean that you weren't sitting around that incubator all night and all day with your kangaroo care trying to save that baby that you don't think it's a baby. We have, in hard, horrific choices, we make choices between persons. It doesn't mean we don't think these are persons. So the fact that we can easily choose the born person versus the unborn person in tragedy doesn't mean a pro-lifer doesn't think that it's a person. It's just that the pro-lifer is recognizing that a person already here has more to lose, because that person has relationships and connections and experience and certain types of means of suffering. For example, if you died at 1 year old suffocating on smoke, you would be pained. But you would not be pained if you were an embryo. You're not far enough along to have the sensation of suffering, at least as far as we know it. A lot of reasons why if you are seriously, significantly, honestly, and consistently pro-life, you'd still choose the baby. It does not at all prove that you don't make good on your commitment that embryo people are people. So you, just by the fact that you would make a choice for an older person, doesn't, you know, older than an embryo, doesn't mean you think that these aren't sacrifices.
What about between the 92-year-old and the embryo? You have one to say.
92-year-old.
Yeah, but are you pro-life?
In your scenario.
You're not, though.
If you're working this through.
If you are, you can answer. But see, here's the problem. We'd have to have somebody who's actually card-carrying pro-life. And even then, we'd probably have some real thought about it. My guess is there'd be some real thought, except that right now, the every embryo's chance of being a baby is only 15%. So if that was a beloved grandfather in very good health, and you knew you only had a 15% chance of that cycle of IVF letting that embryo come to fruition in the sense that we can recognize personhood in babies, you might choose the 92-year-old. On the other hand, if technology was increased, or the reason that you were doing in vitro wasn't actually a woman's own fertility, for example, with Lance Armstrong, famously, his first wife had in vitro because of his testicular cancer, but she was a prime 20-year-old. Her chances of an in vitro procedure resulting in a live birth, I think they had twins, sky high. She, if she were pro-life, might actually take the embryos, as a matter of fact. So, any rate, experiment over. Now here's our point. They gave it the old college try. And I think the arguments are fun, if not entirely persuasive. But Mylander isn't laughing. Mylander is a deontologist who is pro-life, who takes the arguments about stem cell research, and he's adamantly opposed to stem cell research, very, very seriously, and he very much resents bringing in just war analogy to talk about the sacrifice and slaughter of babies for something like chronic and, to an extent, manageable disease. He takes offense. So he's on the war path against them on this piece. Let's talk about just war. Many pro-lifers are deontologists. Many pro-choicers are deontologists, too. Right? Half the room is consequentialist, half the room is deontologist. But he's absolutely going to speak from the theological, deontological perspective. Now, you can be a just war theorist and secular, or a just war theorist and you know, be theocentric, you know, have a theological commitment. Doesn't matter. Just war theory is a deontological theory or argument that tries to explain war, justify war under some very extreme conditions against the accusation that deontologists will not get their hands dirty even in horrific, abhorrent, life and societally altering circumstances. Like what? What would be the kind of circumstance that someone would say to a deontologist, are you going to stand by and let this happen because you don't want to have any, because of thou shalt not kill? You're going to stand by and let this happen because you don't want to get your hands dirty because you say, oh, I don't kill people, I don't send people to war, I don't believe in armies. What would be the circumstance that would invite the accusation, are you going to stand by and let this happen?
Genocide.
Just war is a theory that tries to explain why a deontologist in good conscience can justify a war response, what is the word for war? I mean, military. Ooh, it wasn't that, it's just a word I don't use a lot. Yeah, all right. Military response to genocide. Because the alternative is, well, we're just going to talk to those Nazis. We're just going to explain to them, no. The communists and the gay and lesbians and the Jews, they're really nice people. Let's just talk it out. Let's just talk it out while 6-7 million people are just getting, or any other way, we're just going to talk. Look, at a certain point, genocide is happening, and we're still talking. That's why just war theory got developed, to try to understand how you could actually hold the principles of thou shalt not kill seriously and in a heartfelt way and still say we need a military response to this. Okay. Now, the thing about just war is you really are talking about genocide. And that means that deontologists in general who subscribe to just war theory think that there's almost no wars that have actually occurred that were justified. Right, we got to pull out the Nazis because that's one where, for whatever reasons, we got into the war. There actually was a genocide going on. There were other genocides we just turned a blind eye to and didn't look. Just war theory would have held. We needed to get in there. We needed to get in there and have a military response to stop it. So just war not only condemns, for example, the United States for wars that it's engaged in, it condemns the United States for not having military responses to genocide that we didn't engage in. Okay, but the idea here is genocide. Now, when we return to the question of Parkinson's and type 2 diabetes and paralysis, are we talking about genocide? And you know we're not. So when you're talking about it, now remember, if you're pro-choice and you think that stem cells are a serious matter, but they're not persons, then you're not going to be hit by the Mylander critique because you don't think they're actually people that are being sacrificed. So to do something that is of serious weight for the good of the nation, for the good of people suffering, is a lot different than killing a bunch of babies for the good of the nation. So this is the pro-life deontological response to let's kill babies for Parkinson's disease. And he takes great issue at it because he says this is not a supreme emergency. The thing about just war is that it's not any old crisis that allows and justifies a military response. It's only an emergency of the highest order. And he uses this wonderful phrase, the heavens are about to fall.
And it's not just, this is not a consequentialist argument, this is not. If we don't do this, a lot of bad things are going to happen. It's justified in a different ground. It's this. Allowing what's happening to continue threatens morality herself, threatens moral life as we know it, unturns everything we believe we know about what we owe human beings. If you can just slaughter them out, just slaughter masses of them, as if they're nothing but, at the worst, cattle, and often just a swarm of bees, and you just take them out with the raid. When we start treating human beings like that, all moral life is threatened. When we genocidally kill the same way we slaughter herds or bugs, we have unseated our whole moral fabric. And that's why it's about to be the case that the heavens are about to fall. It's of that level of import. It's not, well, this nasty dictator did this nasty thing to this one, and then I didn't get my oil, and then I didn't have my thing, and then I didn't like this person because they didn't know. It's nothing like that. It's got to be so much higher than that, that if you allow it to continue, you can't say you're a moral agent anymore. You can't allow this to happen to human personhood, to humanity itself. That's how grave just war is. So there's very few examples. And Parkinson's isn't one of them. There are conditions for when you are able, and this is what happens in the theory, it's that you set aside your deontological prohibition against killing for a very constrained period of time, for a very constrained, though, you know, not constrained in numbers, but a very time-constrained and locale-constrained problem. You set aside the thou shalt not kill, you go in and get that thing stopped by the least military means possible, but that could involve killing. And as soon as you stop that genocide, you immediately reinstate all of the prohibitions against killing. That's just war theory. You get the problem solved, and now you're back to moral life. So it can't be something chronic. It can't be, well, we've got this faction fighting this faction. It's been going on, it's going on, it's going on. They kill a three here, they kill four there. Next month they kill 10, the next month they kill five. That kind of chronic and small scale, that can't be a just war. Because then the norm of setting aside, the norm of thou shalt not kill is set aside on a more permanent basis. Now, we don't have the thou shalt not kill. We have the I go in and shoot you because you shot a bunch of people, then I go in and I shoot you and because you shot a bunch of people, and I go shoot you. Well, now, we just can shoot people whenever we need to solve a problem. It isn't an aberration. It's not an unturning of moral life as of our moral code for a temporary time. It's just the new status quo. And the new status quo is fight fire with fire, eye for an eye, or whatever else it is. It's just you kill, then I come in and kill, and you kill, and I come in and kill. Well, that's not deontological. That's not a moment. And the moment, he calls it, is when we have to become utilitarians, all of us, in extremity. And what he means by that is, if the circumstance gets dire enough, all the card-carrying deontologists, like the teacher in front of you, ditches deontology and becomes a consequentialist for that moment in that constrained period of time to save moral life as we know it. Everyone becomes a consequentialist if the circumstance is dire enough. That's his argument. But after the problem is solved, we have to reinstate. And he argues that can't be true of this kind of disease, like chronic illness. Because for one thing, we've got other things to try besides killing babies, like pharmaceutical interventions, or maybe animal cells, or, you know, who knows, gene transfer, maybe adult stem cells. We've got all kinds of avenues we could think of without hacking up the babies. He says that there has to be two conditions for a just war. There has to be, and this plays to this one, the strategic necessity, and there has to be a moral necessity. A strategic necessity means there is no other way. That's actually the bill of goods that we were sold when we originally went into Iraq. I think it was Iraq, yeah, back so many years ago, because the argument was that there was no other way to stop what was going to happen. What was that? What the threat was? What was the reason?
Weapons of mass destruction.
There was nothing else to be done but to go in there
and get those weapons of mass destruction, because maybe they had the smallpox already hooked up to arrows, or, you know, I don't know what the disease was, anthrax and whatever. They had the chemical weapons. They had them all there in Iraq. And the only thing we could do was go in to stop the weapons of mass destruction. There was nothing else we could do. Now, obviously, there was something else we could do, because guess what? There weren't any weapons of mass destruction. There was a struggling country, didn't have the weapons that we thought they had. So actually, we went in for the reason that we thought that there was nothing else to be done about something that wasn't even there. So strategic necessity means there can be, remember, this is a deontological argument here. Consequentialist-wise, you might say, oh yeah, but the greatest good for the greatest number was still achieved by what we did in Iraq. That would be, I don't know, you'd have to sell me on it, but it would be a consequentialist argument. Deontologically, you're nowhere with Iraq. It's very, very difficult to justify that particular war deontologically, because there actually wasn't the threat that we said was the justifying reason for it. So it's going to be an uphill climb. Consequentialism-wise, you might be able to make a good argument. I'd have to hear how the greatest good was served by the way that we went in there and what we did. But strategic necessity, we did not rise to that level because there were other things that could be done. For example, we could have listened to the Europeans who said, I don't think there's any weapons of mass destruction there. That would have been one thing we could have done, for example. Or we could have gone in and looked harder. There's other things that we could have done. So it didn't meet the strategic necessity bar. Now, morally, if there had been weapons of mass destruction, maybe there would have been some thought that, you know, deontologically, maybe there would have been a moral necessity. If you could wipe out the whole world with some kind of nasty, you know, Ebola type of virus, maybe there would be a moral, you know, imperative, I don't know. But a just war requires both a strategic and a moral necessity. So now we turn to those diseases. Is there a strategic necessity? We already said, well, not until we've exhausted. You're killing babies for it, not until you've actually exhausted stem cell, adult stem cell and other kinds of gene transfer and pharmaceutical interventions and who knows what else to exhaust. And there is not a moral necessity because, again, think about the community itself. Moral life is actually not threatened even though we have these horrible diseases. Can you tell me why moral life itself is not threatened? Give me an argument why moral life is not only not threatened by Parkinson's or type 2 diabetes or paralysis, but it might be arguably enhanced. Which doesn't mean that I wish those diseases on anybody. I'm simply saying, is it a moral necessity that we are able to cure Parkinson's today? It's a moral necessity. Well, I think there's at least good reason to argue it's not a moral necessity, and not only that, it may actually have some moral upside.
You could say that maybe having the example of Parkinson's augments our intuitions about empathy and compassion.
Exactly. If we were invulnerable, for example, this is something piece for those of you who are with me in the end of life class in the summer. So a wonderful piece about that Martha Nussbaum wrote, where she talks about how if we were invulnerable, the way the gods are supposed to be invulnerable in ancient Greek mythology and work. In their philosophy and drama and all that, you actually don't need morality because morality is only in play when you have vulnerable creatures. What would it mean, for example, to have to, you know, feed the poor if you couldn't have any poverty because you were totally invulnerable? Your body sustained itself without any food, for example. Or what would it mean to rescue someone in a crisis if there couldn't be any bodily crisis because you couldn't die? Having vulnerability is actually what makes human beings have to have morality in the first place. So if you didn't have any disease, didn't have any way for people to die, you would take a big chunk. And maybe that's fine. Maybe we're happy to get rid of morality. But if you're going to argue it's a moral necessity, you're not going to be able to say we should get rid of all disease. We should fight as hard as we can, because it's not going to be a possibility that we ever fully eradicate it. But it's not that there's a moral necessity to end all disease today. In fact, there are some benefits that we get, like the way that we value each other, the way that our non-invincibility actually makes us have to care and protect each other in the way that we do. And that's certainly true when you have somebody who's ill. But what else, and concretely, what happens, what are some of the things that are displayed when one is in company or interacting with somebody who is ill? What other moral acts? Empathy, for sure. What else?
Philanthropy.
What is it?
Philanthropy.
All right. So we actually have the generosity of giving, you know, even to strangers. Okay, what else?
Self-sacrifice.
What is it?
Self-sacrifice.
All right, self-sacrifice. So I might say, I'm going to take care of you, even though right now I might be doing, I mean, want to do something else, but I'm going to take care of you. And what does it feel like to be the person who's on the receiving end of a generosity like that? What is that? I mean, sometimes it can feel too much, right? These are things that have to be in balance. But what does it feel like to have somebody be willing to do that for you? Right. It feels like it's validating. It's redeeming. It's a reinforcement of how much someone cares about you. These are all things that aren't small in moral life. And so the idea that moral life as we know it will be completely undermined, we'll have no moral life unless we get rid of Parkinson's, is not supportable. We will have moral life. That doesn't mean we shouldn't fight to create cures for disease. It doesn't mean we shouldn't pour our philanthropic dollars into research. It means that even if there is disease, moral life will not expire. In fact, moral life is propped up by our vulnerability. It does not threaten moral life that people are sometimes ill. In fact, all people at some point get ill. It does not threaten moral life at all. So it couldn't possibly be a moral imperative. Now, can you give me a disease that would be a moral imperative? Right now, we don't actually have one. That's right. Because right now, we don't have a plague, an Ebola, that is so 100% fatality and sweeping the whole world. That's just the plot of a movie. If it were, though, the case that we had a disease spreading from nation to nation, we actually would have a moral necessity. Because if there's no people, guess what? There's no morality. So moral life would be threatened in certain types of pandemic. Not the kind where you have a 5% fatality. That's very sad, and we need to get those vaccines. But one that has an 80, 90, 95% fatality rate, or 100%, now there we got a moral necessity, because we're going to lose all the people. And when you lose all the people, you've lost the moral life too. That's the kind of thing where we could have some moral necessity. Yeah, well, Parkinson's and type 2 diabetes aren't threatening in that way, as sad as they are as diseases. So then when we return to Mylander, and he's trying to think about whether you can kill babies for diseases on the basis of just war, he gets his hackles up. It's just not even going to be debated in deontological circles about whether you can kill people to find cures for this set of diseases. Okay, thoughts overall? Questions?
Mm-hmm. What really worries me is that when you're talking about stem cells, it looks like these people had no conscious of what is tissue culture, cell culture. I mean, that embryo in a dish won't be able to survive a couple of hours. You don't have a cell biologist, culturist who is facilitating that survival of that embryo in that mm-hmm. dish.
That's true. Without the right conditions, your embryo is fried. But your 24-weeker without a whole lot of technology is also not going to make it very far. So I'm not sure how that helps the argument. In other words, just because we're dependent, or your person in the ICU. If you're in the ICU, presumably you actually need that life-sustaining technology or your life doesn't get sustained. So an embryo in a dish, an embryo person in a dish, needs certain kinds of scientists around to support them. NICU people need certain kinds of technology to support their life when they're at 24 weeks, as do people in the intensive care unit. But all of those, the fact that we need that kind of dependence doesn't alter whether we're life or not.
But when I am thinking about the embryo outside and the embryo inside the mom, the chances that an embryo that is conceived in any woman to survive is very high. I mean, that to go through the full pregnancy is maybe higher than these embryos that are in the dish and are dependent.
For sure. If you naturally conceive, depending on whether you're going to talk about whether the thing implants or not, you've got a better chance than 15%.
You don't have to be a scientist.
I know, but I don't understand how that helps with the argument, because what I'm arguing here is that we things that we recognize as people, like neonates or people in MICUs, also have to depend fully for their sustenance on other human beings and technology.
Yeah, but the embryo in a dish is the only way that can survive is with the scientists.
Mm-hmm.
There is no one. The embryo in a woman's body, it can be a scientist, it can be rich, it can be...
But how does it help the argument? That's what I'm not getting at. Because here's the problem. It's true that a full-term baby doesn't need anything either except just to make sure you give it some milk. And the neonate needs more technology. But nobody's going to deny that they're both babies. Yeah, I'm not getting it.
How can this this embryo in a dish can be a baby?
So you're just not a pro-lifer. Because I think if you were, it'd be pretty clear, just like my NICU baby and my full-fledged baby. My full-fledged term, I mean full-to-term baby. You don't go to the NICU and say, well, this one needs some technology, I guess it's not a baby. No, 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 everybody's around it like it's a baby, and we got the kangaroo care and all that thing. Alrighty.
If you were a pro-lifer, couldn't it be argued that you couldn't even do, eventually, if you're going to back it up...
There are plenty of pro-lifers who do not think in vitro is proper. But that's something considered. The Catholic Church takes a stance like that. But there are plenty of pro-lifers who say that while there is this sad fact that some of the babies won't get used, and that's why they want embryo adoption... The beauty, the place, the centrality of children in the satisfaction, having a satisfactory human life, makes that a trade-off that they are willing to undergo. But you will not find many pro-lifers who don't wish that they would only make the number of embryos that they need. Unfortunately, right now the choice is, like, you think about a pro-life couple that's, let's say, in their 60s, and they want their kids, they want grandchildren. And the daughter or the daughter-in-law can only have a child through in vitro. What they wish is that technology would be far enough along so that all the embryos that woman needs, that's all that get made. But they're not going to say, I don't want a grandchild because it has this problem that technology is not far enough along. So it's not inconsistent. It's just that, there's nothing that can be done yet. That's why people often talk about embryo adoption. Sure, that though.
I don't think about embryo. I'm thinking.
Alrighty, what else?
Okay.
Before we head out.
Just kind of a small thing. Do you think Mylander is specific enough in his use of just war to indicate on that term in the same way that we're saying Kaplan and McGee equivocate on the use of community? So is he saying that just war is, a genocide in a situation where it's, sheer numbers, or is it genocide in the situation of a certain, threshold at which that's a percentage of the population, some population, some specified area that died?
Well, he does go through a whole thing about how, and he doesn't say it's only genocide. He doesn't name that. It's the type of thing he's talking about. So he's not equivocating for sure. And not only that, he's fence-sitting. So he's not equivocating in the sense of committing a philosophical sin. He's admitting to you that he doesn't know where to draw the lines, and it's more of an argument like this. Just war theorists sometimes know it when they see it. We know genocide when we see it. On the other hand, there'll be cases where a just war justification for military action might seem true for one deontologist and not for another. And that's why he goes through this whole thing in the piece about how there can be disagreements among deontologists about where just war, what rises to the level of the just war. So on certain cases, everybody agrees. On other cases, there's discrepancy. He knows that he and just war theorists have to do a lot of work to try to figure out where that line is. But it's not an equivocation. He's admitting it full out, full stop. He's saying, I know, it's hard to draw the line. With certain cases, like the Holocaust, not hard to draw the line, or the Tutsis and the Hutus. You can think of genocides that have gone on in the world. They're not gray. Then there are others where it's like, is it gray or not? Or conditions like some kind of worldwide pandemic that had a high fatality. All right, let's wrap it up.
Thank
Great.
You.
See you when? 2 weeks from now.